the week of October 14th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 427, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, but I'm not talking to you, Michael Gill.
And why aren't you talking to me? It sounded like you were talking to me just now.
You know why I'm not talking to you.
You're not talking to me. Well, you certainly won't be talking to me for at least 2 weeks.
Yep. Sperling's going on a trip.
Yes, so going on two weeks. Yes.
2 weeks without the show. 2 weeks.
It really is my fault this time. Normally, he just blames me, and it's really his fault. But, you know, indeed, it is my fault.
Are they business trips?
They are both business trips. One is to Show East, which is in Miami, which is next week. And then the following week, it is to MENA, which is in, of all places, Dubai.
And it's so sad that they have no internet connection in Miami or Dubai. Someday, those struggling little towns will, in fact, join the modern world.
Well, you know, you never know. You never know with hurricanes.
That's right. So we will be off for the next 2 weeks. Our next show will be November 4th, the week of November 4th. We hope to get back in there. Of course, it's the holiday season. A lot of stuff will be going on. We're going to have Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. So we'll be trying to stay on top of stuff. But for 2 weeks, you're going to have a break from us, sad to say.
Unless you want to invite us over for Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, in which case, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
And we will show up.
Yes, we will.
And to follow up on the story from last week, to a little more clarification, we talked about how the National, the theater in London, the theater complex, I should say, is trying to find a new sponsor for their subsidized tickets. I compared it to the Signature Theater Company here, but maybe an even better comparison in America is the Public and their Shakespeare in the Park, which is a free annual event in the park that happens. They have two or three shows. They're free. Everybody swarms to see them. It's great fun. The National has subsidized tickets for a lot of their shows, and they've been sponsored by Travelex for the last 15 years. Now they need someone new. One complicating factor, Brexit.
Oh,
no company
that's right.
knows where they're going to be based. Nobody knows what sort of financial strains they're going to be facing. There's just a host of unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld would say. There are known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns, and nobody knows what's going to happen with Brexit. So people just aren't in the mood necessarily to commit to a multi-year sponsorship of anything. And look at golf. The British Masters can't find a new sponsor. And people are saying it's because of Brexit. Nobody knows what's going to happen. So the tournament probably won't happen in 2019. That happened just a few years ago that they had to cancel the Masters for a year or two because they couldn't find a sponsor for the tour. The sad fact is that British golfers are really on a roll. So it's a great time to be a golfer in the UK. Europe's always got strong golfing talent. And it's a shame that the Masters may have to skip a year. We're skipping a show. They're skipping a year. But right now, at least, we are doing the podcast. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll be talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees. I'm so glad we were included this year. The Hall announced its shortlist, and I'll quiz Michael on who should get in, who doesn't belong on the list, and what music will really last. In China news, Fan Bingbing is still not missing anymore, so that's kind of nice. Plus, China announced its official nominee for the Foreign Language Oscar, and some drug smugglers are not going to be pleased. In book filter news, we've got a book you really should check out of the library. Oh, and the shortlist for the National Book Awards have been released, and Michael is, well, embarrassed, frankly. On Inside Baseball, the rush by every media company on the planet to launch their own streaming service is picking up steam, and each company is pledging to spend more money on content than the next. Plus, Jeffrey Katzenberg has finally given his new TV project its name. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. The cops are coming. I don't know if you can hear that. I'm on the 14th floor, and yet you can hear everything on the streets of New York. Ambulances, fire trucks, cops. That stuff is happening all day long. But we've got our weekend box office, and we link to ComScore in our show notes. We also get information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times. You, our listeners. And if you check our notes, and a lot of people do, they love to check the links to all the stories we talk about. They check out some of the information we provide that we are pulling from, that we don't always cover every single item. We've got lovely new charts this week for the box office charts from North America and the worldwide box office. Thank you, Sperling, for spiffing them up.
Not a problem.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world for the second, third, Venom. It's Venom, $105 million, $378 million worldwide. So this is already a hit. Another comic book movie, a spun-off from the Spider-Man universe. Sony made it. Critics were not thrilled, but fans are perfectly happy. At number two around the world is another big hit, A Star is Born. Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, they made $48 million on the weekend. They're at $135 million worldwide. Both of these movies have easily tripled their budget. They're going to quadruple it, and they're going to keep going strong. I think ultimately, at least in North America, you can see that A Star is Born is already catching up quite quickly with Venom. And I think it's going to pass it eventually. And since it cost about a third of the price, that movie cost $35 million to make, whereas Venom cost $100 million to make. They're both hits. They're both good. But A Star is Born is really there for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen A Star is Born yet, and I do want to see it, and will see it while it's in theaters. So, you know,
that maybe it's time to let the old days die.
Yeah, sorry. So $28 million this weekend. Maybe if it drops to $25 million, $22 million, that's pretty good next weekend.
It made $48 million worldwide this week, and that was domestically.
Yes.
No, it's doing just terrific. It's about to pass the $100 million mark in North America. So that's profitable ultimately in North America alone. So you're always doing well when that happens. It also has the number one album in the country. The soundtrack is at number one. The duet between Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga is at number five on the top 10 in the Billboard song charts. So they're tearing it up. That's what you want with a soundtrack. This is the third soundtrack of the year to top the Billboard charts. You had, I think, Greatest Showman, Black Panther, and now A Star is Born. That hasn't happened in a few years. So that's a lot of activity for movie music. The music in First Man is certainly interesting. That's the Damien Chazelle film starring Ryan Gosling as the first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong. First Man opened up this weekend. It made $25 million worldwide. It's a disaster.
Have you seen it?
I have. And it's gotten polite and admirable reviews from critics who sort of admire it, but they don't love it. And audiences are less excited. The couple person I took to a screening, he's like, well, it was good. Another friend saw it and she said, it was okay. So people are not thrilled. It has a B+ cinema score, whatever that means. If it's not an A, it means they didn't love it. That's basically what it means. So critics were nicer to First Man than, say, Venom. But Venom, the audiences actually liked. In this case, audiences are sort of indifferent to First Man. And every week, if a movie doesn't click immediately, there's a think piece. Why didn't it work? Well, you know, the people just didn't like the movie that much. You know, it's not rocket science, right?
Well, in the case of First Man, it literally was about rocket science. So, yes, I think it might have something to do with rocket science. Maybe people aren't interested in rocket science.
I have to say, I liked it 10 times more than Whiplash or La La Land, neither film of which I liked. I didn't even finish Whiplash, and La La Land I really didn't care for, and I love musicals. I wanted to like it. So I thought it was good. I didn't think it was great. It won't be on my best of the year list, but it was an admirable film, great sound mix and sound design. I think it will definitely compete in that category. I feel sorry for the film in a way. I mean, I liked it more than Chazelle's other two movies. And you know, before it came out, we heard, oh, it's unpatriotic. It's super, you know, left wing, because they didn't show the flag planting on the moon, which is silly if you see the movie. And now that it's come out, The New Yorker and The New York Times have said it's right wing. They're like, it's nostalgic for the 50s, which is crazy if you see the film. I mean,
especially since it takes place mostly in the 60s.
Well, they're just nostalgic for that era of white straight men being in charge and the wife sat at, it's like, it's weird. The movie does not paint him as a villain, but it doesn't say, oh, gee, I want to be like Neil Armstrong, tightly wound and hard to emotionally connect with other people. You know, it's a strange argument that it's too right wing. So these poor people, they're like, first they're too left wing, now they're too right wing. They're like, we just made a movie about landing on the moon.
Look at how much they jump through time constantly in that movie, because they're kind of crunching 10 years into 2 hours. And frankly, we all know how it's going to end. We were all, you know, well, I wasn't there necessarily, but you know, history.
We're familiar with what happened. Yes, they faked the landing on the moon.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, very funny. at the end, you know, the flag is shown. It's not, we don't see them planted in the ground, but it's
there. That's not even an argument. That's just silly. Don't talk about that. That's just nonsense. That's absurd. Complete and utter nonsense. If you see the movie, it's not even remotely unpaid. It's just silly. In fact, the New Yorker and New York Times argue it's too right-wing and patriotic and dissing people, anybody who dares to criticize the program, which I don't agree with that either. It's just a solid, interesting performance from Ryan Gosling. I thought Claire Foy was good as his wife. She has the Oscar moment where she gets to let loose. There's an emotional payoff at the end of the film. I just thought it was an interesting, pretty good movie. You know, it wasn't great.
And I would agree with you regarding the sound. I saw it in Atmos, and I got to tell you, that opening scene, and I'm not giving anything away here, where he's the test pilot and he's flying that plane that's faltering. Boy, oh boy,
that sucker shakes.
That is amazing. Especially the audio is amazing.
Sorry about that. Talking over. Yeah, you don't want to be in the rocket ship or in test pilot mode. That's really looks dangerous.
Yes.
But back to the charts. At number four around the world is Smallfoot, the animated film with the voice of Channing Tatum. $23 million on the weekend, $110 million worldwide. That's playing in 58 territories. We'll have to wait. It looks like it's doing okay. At number five, the big success in China right now is Project Gutenberg, the Chow Yun-fat film. $22 million on the weekend, $140 million worldwide and counting. It's here in New York. It's playing at the in Times Square, one of those two theaters. It's definitely the big winner of the national holiday, the 10-10 holiday that we just had in China. There are a couple other movies that are doing pretty well as well, but we'll get more to about why the box office in China perhaps is slowing down a little bit. It hasn't been a great last 2 months, and there are a couple reasons that we can look at. At number six is a film getting ready for Halloween. It's Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. $19 million on its opening weekend. The original one really starred Jack Black. This one has Jack Black in more of a cameo, I guess. He just sort of pops in because he has another haunted house sort of film called The House with a Clock in Its Walls. That made another $10 million this weekend and passed the $100 million mark. Both movies should be okay when all is said and done, though Goosebumps, I imagine, wishes it had started off a little bit stronger. At number seven is the Rowan Atkinson James Bond spoof, Johnny English Strikes Again. $11 million on the weekend. That's at $80 million worldwide. If it doubles that amount and it still hasn't opened up in North America, the movie will be okay. And number eight is a film that MoviePass was certainly pushing very hard, Bad Times at the El Royale. $11 million on its opening weekend, mostly mixed reviews. Audiences aren't wildly excited. I imagine this one will fade fast. At number nine, quite the different story is Night School with Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart. That's doing quite well. $10 million on the weekend, $75 million worldwide. It is in 24 territories. So hopefully this is one of those comedies that can cross over. It's made $15 million overseas, and hopefully that number will keep rising because Kevin Hart is a star and they should be able to promote his movies worldwide and make money off them. Jumping over The House with a Clock in Its Walls is one of the other hits from the China holiday season. It's Shadow, the film directed by Zhang Yimou. $8 million on the weekend. It's made $80 million so far, which seems to me like a lot of money for this type of period serious drama.
Is it playing in the U.S.? Because I'd love, you know, I like Zhang Yimou, so I'd like to see it, but I don't know if it's playing in the U.S.
It hasn't opened here yet. It's in three territories right now, okay. But it has not come to the U.S.
It's got a great poster.
Oh, yeah?
With the little calligraphy, yeah.
At number 12 is another Chinese drama, Lost Found. That made another $8 million on the weekend. That's well behind those big movies. And at number 13, we head over to Korea, where Dark Figure of Crime, I love that phrase, made another $5 million on the weekend. That's at $18 million worldwide. We don't know the budget, but if you do, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
If you're not aware, our show is loosely scripted with a dollop of improv. Sperling never knows when we're going to throw that in. He has to stay on top of things and be ready to whip that information out at any moment.
Yes, he never actually tells me. Michael never tells me when he's going to throw that in.
You got to stay on top of yourself. Number 14 is The Nun. That's at the $360 million mark worldwide. That's doing great. As is The Incredibles 2. Still in theaters. Still playing in 18 territories. Still pulling in some money. $1,227 million worldwide. At number 16 is Hello, Mrs. Money. That's the Chinese comedy that got pretty poor reviews, but you know what? It's made its money back. I'm sure it didn't cost that much. It's at $82 million worldwide. Now we head over to India, where, our next film is Hitchkey, or Hiccup, as it's known in English. This is it. Did you get what I did there?
I got what you did, yeah.
It's an Indian drama, sort of a light comic drama, a tearjerker, really. It's the inspirational true story. It's a fictional film, but it's based on the inspirational true story of a teacher with Tourette's who teaches underprivileged kids. So you get two heart-tugging ideas there for the price of one. Interestingly enough, it's based on the memoir of an American man, Brad Cohen, but this is a Hindi film starring a woman, actress Rani Mukherjee, and it made $4 million this weekend. It's at $15 million worldwide. I guess that's still in China. I'm not sure why it wasn't on the charts.
China,
before.
You mean India?
I mean, in India. I'm trying to figure out whether it played in India and is now opening in China, because it's China Nadig is the distributor. So I'm guessing now it probably already played out in India and has now opened up in China, and that's where it's made $4 million. That's what I think may be what's going on there. Make sense?
That makes perfect sense to me, and that's exactly what often happens with those films.
That's right. And again, when you talk about the Chinese box office and how international they are, they have hit films that really make serious money from India and from Korea and sometimes Japan and, of course, America. So that's a lot better. It's more of an international audience than American audiences who often do not go see foreign language films. You know, you're lucky if a foreign language film makes $5 million or $10 million. That would be a really good showing for most of them, right?
Yeah, I mean, not every movie is like Amelie that makes $100 million.
Right. Those are few and far between. And certainly when you're looking at Indian films or Chinese films or Korean films, you know, French films have crossed over a little bit. But even there, yeah, the big hits are few and far between. But here you've got movies they'll make $10, $20, $30 million all the time in China. So you got to respect that audience is used to seeing films from all over the world, not just the Hollywood blockbusters that you don't need to read the subtitles in order to follow what's going on. But at number 18, a film that probably won't play in China, A Simple Favor. $3 million on the weekend, $83 million worldwide. I don't know. It's in 63 territories. Maybe it is playing in China. But that's done very, very well in North America. And now it's crossing over. It's made almost, you know, it's made $50 million in the U.S. and $30 million internationally. So that movie is, you know, a comedy starring two American actresses, Anna Faris, of course. And that's doing quite well. And number 19 is Disney's Christopher Robin. $3 million on the weekend, $186 million worldwide. Aladdin 2, that French comedy about Aladdin, a sequel, that's still chugging along at the theaters. And it's in theaters the same week that Disney has released the teaser trailer for their live-action adaptation of their animated musical, Aladdin. That was just like a 1.5-minute trailer. Showed almost nothing, just desert sands and our hero grabbing the lamp. But it was very lavish, very expensive looking, a good teaser. You know, I imagine trailer number 2 will be more action-y, and trailer number 3 will give us a glimpse of a song.
Right, and maybe Will Smith as the genie.
That's right. Yeah, we'll get Will Smith as the genie. Scrolling down, Adam Sandler's movie Hotel Transylvania 3, that's back in some theaters. That's past the $500 million mark worldwide. Fat Buddies, that Chinese cop comedy that Sperling and I are going to be remaking for North America, that's at $35 million. Here's a movie, The Titan. This movie opened up in China. It's a sci-fi flick starring Sam Worthington, who really can't wait for Avatar 2. He's so excited for Avatar 2. This movie made $1.9 million on the weekend. I guess it opened up on a Wednesday or something. It's at $2.6 million worldwide. And the last movie we're going to mention is The Hate U Give. That's a film in the North American box office. It's only on like 250 screens or something, and it's sort of breaking up. It's doing quite well. You know, it's making a pretty good solid average, and did it break in the top 10? Yes, it broke into the top 10 in North America. It's at number 9. So I don't think it's going to really be a big hit, but it's holding well, expanding slowly, maybe building up word of mouth. So it's doing what you want to do when you have a small film and you want to see if you can reach a wider audience. That hasn't happened for the Redford film, The Old Man and the Gun, or the Sisters Brothers. I haven't seen either film. I really want to see both of them. I'm going to go soon. And those movies have gotten good reviews, but they have not translated into the box office, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping the Sisters Brothers would do well because it's an Annapurna picture, and you want to see a new distribution company. You want to see them do well.
Well, what's going to happen at the distribution company of IMAX? They're not a distribution. What's going to happen at the format company or whatever you call them, IMAX? I don't know what you call them, but they've just had a change at in one division. Meg Colligan of Paramount is becoming the president of IMAX Entertainment.
Yeah, I think IMAX Entertainment is the distributor. IMAX is the exhibitor. I always get confused, and I'm in that space, and I get confused. one story will call them an exhibitor, another story will call them a distributor, another article will call them the filmmakers behind, the documentary. So I don't know. I wish they would kind of market themselves in a standard way. But I think IMAX Entertainment is the actual distribution company.
And she's going to have relationships with studios, right?
Yes.
Right. So she's working with them, and she wants people to see as IMAX as more than just the big popcorn comic book movies.
Right.
She
and Greg Foster is leaving, and Greg Foster is the guy who helped kind of create the whole, IMAX is kind of a premium format for blockbuster films. That said, he might be leaving just as the getting is good or going is good. I don't know what the expression, but right now you've got all of these exhibitors coming out with their own premium formats. So IMAX as a brand is more of a brand than a technology.
Well, unless the movie is shot in IMAX, I don't want to see it on an IMAX screen. That's how I've always felt. They love to say, hey, come see these movies in IMAX. But the first thing I want to do is find out, well, was any of it shot in IMAX and how much?
I mean, the good news now, especially with these Alexa cameras, right, is that you can blow up the footage to ridiculous heights with very little loss of image quality. And with film, that just wasn't possible. But, you get grain the size of boulders.
I just don't think the IMAX screens are a good way to see a movie that wasn't shot to be seen in that way. Unless you're shot and intended to be shown in the IMAX screen format, whatever camera you shoot it on, unless the director says, yes, I want you all to watch this film in IMAX, then I don't want to see it on an IMAX screen because it's not a normal screen. It's a gigantic enveloping, going to the sides, it's a different experience.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that First Man was released in IMAX, but I think though he didn't shoot it in IMAX, he intended to release it in IMAX.
I think a few screen. Well, they intend to release everything in IMAX. That doesn't mean that's the way the director wants you to see it. I went to an all media screening for the movie. They didn't show it on an IMAX screen. That means, if you're not making the critics watch it in IMAX, you're not making them watch it in 3D. That is not the preferred format for the film.
And I think
that's my standard.
They did show the all media screening here in Los Angeles on an IMAX screen.
Well, they didn't in New York.
I could be wrong.
We were at the theater where they could have. We were at Lincoln Square, so they could have gone upstairs.
Yeah,
no, that was. Well, I don't know if it was the all media. I shouldn't say that. It's one of the adjunct screenings by Byron Bantry, which is sort of a tastemaker company that when they have a film that they think is an Oscar favorite or has a good campaign, those are the films that sort of appeal to adults. They love to go to Brian Bantry and say, hey, do a screening for us with your audience, people that you reach out to, because they know that the people that they pull in will sort of see throughout the community and say, oh, I really liked it. I saw the movie. I really liked it. They'll get talk and buzz about it.
Right.
So that's the purpose of those screenings. And again, I think if that's the best way to see the film, that's how you want them to see it. So Meg is there. She left Paramount under a cloud, not her cloud, but their cloud. She's suing them for gender discrimination. There was sort of a wave of women who left Paramount or were fired were kicked out, and she said it was unfair and it was discrimination, and she is, I think, still suing them, though she says, hey, that won't have any effect on my relationship with them. Business is business.
Yeah, it especially won't have any effect on her relationship with them, since they have no movies for her to distribute anyway.
Well, there are movies being distributed in the Middle Kingdom in China, but the box office is slowing down a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily... Look, we all knew it wasn't going to grow at 50% per year. I mean, that just couldn't keep happening. But it slowed down in August, September, and now into October, it's beginning to cool off a bit. So is the Chinese economy, I might add. But there are a number of factors for that.
Well, what's the biggest one?
Well, I guess online ticketing platforms, their fees are now capped.
Right, so this online companies used to subsidize tickets. They wanted to gain market share, so they'd buy a $10 ticket and sell it to you for $5 if you bought it through their service, like, say, Fandango or something like that. You know, it's the equivalent to that. So Fandango would be selling you a ticket at a lower price than they paid for it, and because they wanted to get market share. That's what was happening in China, and now the government said, hey, enough of that. Don't do that anymore.
Well, also, distributors used to go out there, kind of like in the book world, where you kind of go out and you buy all the copies of the book, and it's like, hey, we're a bestseller.
Well, publishers don't do that.
Well, the agents.
Authors try to game the system, but that's harder and harder to do in the U.S., but yes, it does still happen. They try to stop that bulk buying of books. Normally, if you bulk buy, it doesn't count towards book sales. You know, that's what they, so you have to send people to individual stores to buy, you know, five copies at a time. Otherwise, they say, you can't buy 1,000 copies and have it count towards, you know, sales.
I know this is a non sequitur to what we're discussing, okay? Mm-hmm. But how many, if I was an author, how many books would I have to buy to make the bestseller list?
Well, in the UK, the chart shows you exactly how many copies each book has sold. In the US, that information historically hasn't been available as easily. However, Publishers Weekly sort of does that. They've been doing that a little bit much more recently. The New York Times has a secret formula that they use where they talk to stores and they survey people. They don't exactly necessarily they don't count, right? They don't have book scan, so they don't have access to just saying, all right, it sold this many copies this week. So, but if you look at the Publishers Weekly list, you can see on the hardcover list, which combines frontlist fiction, for example, there are 25 books on the chart. Number 25 is a book called Times Convert by Deborah Harkness. This week, that book sold 2,540 copies.
So all you need to do is go out and buy 2,000 copies of a book, and you're doing pretty good.
Right. So if you want to get in the top 10, you need to sell about 6,000 copies this week. That's where you'll find a Clive Cussler novel. And the number one book, which is a Jodi P. Colt, she's a romance novelist that may be dismissive in some people's minds, women's fiction, I guess, which
right.
is fiction yeah. with women as the lead characters, which means fiction.
Right.
But that's the genre and world that they put her in. She sold 26,000 copies this week. So that's basically the book just launched this week. So 27,000 copies, that would have gotten you number one on the list. So we can assume the New York Times is probably equivalent to that very, very roughly. So if you went out and got, if we got our listeners of the show, if we put out a book and we got our listeners to all buy one copy, we would be in the top 10 of probably the New York Times bestseller list. So if we said Showbiz Sandbox, the book, the way those jerks at Chapo did, I don't like that. But if we did that like they did and had a book actually published and we said, please go, everyone has to go opening weekend to buy it. You have to buy our book the week it comes out. If people went out and bought that book, we would be in the top 10. We would have we'd be able to say New York Times bestselling authors for the rest of our lives.
I'm almost sorry I asked that question. But,
well, you should be. The back to the Middle Kingdom and why the box office slowed down. Maybe the biggest reason is they just haven't had really big hits. That's always a thing. You know, it's, when you have hits, it happens. And the Middle Kingdom is still on more of a seasonal pattern. You know, it's all weird because sometimes we're going to have a big holiday weekend and they don't want Hollywood films. So they say, all right, we'll save those for the off season, which means they have more of a year-round chart than maybe the North America did for a long time. But there are still down periods, whereas in North America, they're really saying, we got to release movies 12 months a year. So that's why Hollywood is setting records in September and October and August and January and March. In China, not happening as much, but hopefully they'll continue to do so. Crazy Rich Asians, by the way, that will be released in China, November 30th in China. Maybe they'll presenting it as a cautionary tale. I'm not sure how they're going to frame it.
Well, the reason that I brought up the whole, you know, how many books do you need to sell? I don't think we actually got to that in the China news here is they're stopping distributors from buying the tickets. They would go in and buy tickets.
Oh, that's the third one. Yeah. The distributors would just try to bump up the sales by, you know, walking and buying tickets. And they're saying, no, you can't do that. So that was gaming the system. Subsidized tickets were gaming the system. Both of those are stopping. And of course, that means we'll get a more accurate sense of how popular and successful movies really are. So while in the short term, it means box office may slow down, in the long term, that is definitely a good thing. That's a healthy sign of the China box office. And they're making quality films, of course, and their Oscar nominee is going to be Hidden Man by Jiang Wen. That's the third in a trilogy. China has named it their Oscar entry for the best foreign language film. I think they should be calling it best international film, by the way. And that won out over Zhang Yimou's Shadow, except it didn't really, because Shadow wasn't eligible. It hadn't come out within the time frame that you have to be released theatrically in order to be named as your country's pick. So Shadow will be eligible potentially for next year's Oscar nominee pick for Best Foreign Language Film. But it did officially beat out Dying to Survive. That's the film about drug smugglers that we thought might be the Oscar pick for China. We're still waiting for that movie to get a North American release. That made a ton of money in the country and has changed things culturally, and the government's looking into issues on healthcare. So that's had a big impact in China, and we thought maybe that would be their pick. But no, it's going to be Jiang Wen, who did have one of my favorite films, Devils on the Doorstep. I saw that at Cannes and really loved that movie. So this film, Hidden Man, set in the 1930s, with a martial artist headed to America, trained as a spy, and then he returns to China.
There's a lot going on in that movie.
Did you see it?
No, your description of it.
Right. We still don't have a report from you about your movie pass and your subscription services in Lake Geneva. Now you got more conferences coming up.
I know. I've been so busy. I have to write up my report from Lake Geneva and the Geneva Convention, specifically because I was the moderator of that panel on movie subscription movie going.
Yeah, one little tidbit from that period was that the Wall Street Journal reported that MoviePass spent $313 million in the first 6 months of 2018 on ticket sales. I don't know how they got that number, but they insist about $300 million was what MoviePass spent buying tickets. That amounts to 5% of the total box office for the first 6 months of the year. Well, that can't be right. That wouldn't be $3 billion, but that'd be more like $5 or $6 billion, wouldn't it? So that percentage may be off, but that's a good chunk of money.
It is. It absolutely is.
And I have officially canceled my MoviePass subscription.
Oh, you know, my goodness.
It became so absurd. You know, okay, you can see a movie on Thursday at 2 p.m. Okay, you can see that movie next Wednesday. And then on Wednesday, you find out you can only see it at noon. You know, it's like, dear God, you know, they're doing everything they can to make sure you don't go see a movie. It's the not movie pass.
I think a part of that is your location, because here in Los Angeles, that is not the case. At least, again,
what do you mean?
This is I think that the price of movies in New York is so high and the subscriber level is so high in New York that they've really severely limited it. Whereas I can go, you know, every time I open the app, just out of curiosity, I'm able to go to some of the, even like new releases, I'm able to go. Now, mind you, again, I'm on that special year-long program, so I don't know whether it's, I wasn't month to month, so I don't know whether it just happens to be me.
Well, have you actually clicked on a theater and seen if you can go to a movie? I mean, in New York, there are two theaters you can go to, Cinepolis Chelsea and the Landmark at 57. I'm sorry, and the Roxy Music, which is a revival house, basically, practically. It only shows movies like once or twice a week. So those two theaters, you can see any new film. I could go to Cinepolis Chelsea and see, you know, A Star Is Born. But for every other theater that they don't have a deal with, like if I go to Kips Bay, there are only two movies available to me, Bad Times at the El Royale and The Hate U Give. That's it. Those are the only two films I can see at that theater.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's not the case for me. When I open up the app, I can see most of the films.
At most theaters?
At most theaters,
I had that happen in Alabama as well. That is not a New York only thing.
Oh, okay.
That's how it works. I don't think you're looking at it right. Unless it's one of their approved, you know, weird little films like Monsters and Men or Free Solo. There are always four or five indie films that are on their list. Very, very small films that are on their approved list. But basically, for new releases, there's just a handful of films, and you can only go see those movies at those theaters.
Yeah, so, I have a feeling it's because I'm on the year-long program. You know, I bought the annual pass.
Yeah, they're basically doing everything they can to make sure you don't go to the movies.
Yeah.
So I have quit it, and I've signed up for Cinemia, and I have it, and I have not used it yet. But I will, and I'll let you know what it's like.
Yeah, I would love to. You know, Rafat, who was on the panel, he's the head of the CEO of Cinemia. He will not give out numbers, but I'm curious to know how many subscribers he has and how many he got. When
$30 a month compared to the $10 a month for MoviePass, but you can actually use it and go to any theater.
Yes.
And you can buy tickets in advance. So that's a win-win for me, but I'll have to see how it works.
It'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings us to our music segment, where this week we will be talking about, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees for 2019, and they've been announced. It will be a big deal when they get picked, of course, more than just an announced. But let's look at the list. I'll guess whether you'd vote to put them in, and then, Michael, you can tell me whether, you know, what your decision is. And wouldn't the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame be much better if we were in charge? I think so, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, so here we go. The Cure. I think that you would include them.
I personally wouldn't, but I have no objection. I had Staring at the Sea, that great singles compilation. They're certainly an influential group. They just don't do anything for me. So I wouldn't vote for them, but I wouldn't campaign against them, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't tell other people, no, no. So, you know, I respect them. I just don't love them.
Yeah, I'm likewise. Def Leppard, I'm going to go with yes.
I'm going to go with no.
Oh,
they had some hit singles. God bless, they had big hit albums, like Journey. Like, that's great, but they shouldn't be in the hall. They are not influential or important. I don't think they're lasting. If you get a greatest hits for them, that's probably even more than you need. I don't wish them ill. They seem like fun. I kind of love the group. I mean, I love the one-armed drummer. I mean, these guys face so much turmoil. I mean, setback after setback, and then the guy being in a car accident, losing his arm, and yet coming back with a new drum kit and becoming just as good a drummer as ever. That's cool. That's great. I like them. They're just not a Hall of Fame group.
Devo, I'm going to go with yes.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, Def Leppard had a lot of hits. Devo had a lot of hit. You know, I mean, who cares? I don't see them as influential or important at all.
I didn't know. I was wondering whether you would have, you know, said yes only because they were the kind of progenitor of prog rock. But other than that,
the prog rock existed long before Devo.
Okay.
Progressive rock was like Moody Blues and Yes way back in the 60s, where they would do long suites and think if they imitated classical music, they were sophisticated, you know. But no, Devo is a new wave, art rocky sort of thing.
Art rock, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Janet Jackson, I'm going to say no, but you're going to say yes. So go ahead.
I'm going to say no too.
Oh, okay.
People said, no, her sound from Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis is so influential. I'm like, yeah, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis deserve to be in the hall as producers or whatever. But Janet Jackson does nothing for me. Besides, he already got in the hall as Michael Jackson. So why should his alter ego get in there as well?
Oh, my goodness. Kraftwerk, I don't know enough, but I'm going to say no.
Absolutely, yes.
Oh,
hugely
okay.
Unique, hugely important, very influential, and like nobody did what they did. They're just off in their own zone making this sort of Berlin synth music, and yet it has been very, very influential for like all sorts of soundtracks and EDM, all sorts of different artists, sampled a lot in hip-hop. They're just a very fascinating, cool, interesting group. Big body of work, influential, and really unique.
LL Cool J... I'm going to say no. You're probably going to say yes.
I'm definitely going to say no.
Oh, okay.
Let him host the Grammys. Nice guy, but not a Hall of Famer.
MC5, no.
I'm going to say yes. They have just three albums.
This is like the worst game for me.
You'll get better. You'll get better. It gets easier as we get towards the bottom. Influential. Very influential. Just three albums. Not all three of them are even that great. Unlike, say, Nick Drake, who had three albums and they're all great from start to finish. But they are definitely a group whose impact has remained. I think they're like Nick Drake or some other bands where they only did one or two albums, but really influential.
Stevie Nicks. I'm going to say no, and here's why. She's already in as a member of Fleetwood Mac.
And does that mean you don't think her solo work deserves it on its own?
I don't know it well enough as much as I know the, well, maybe, actually, I don't know. I'm kind of torn because I'm like, well, you're kind of already in. Why do we have to let you in twice? And you're taking up somebody else's spot.
Well, the Hall needs more women, but Stevie Nicks is not the way to do it. Just her solo career is not important at all. She has some great singles. I have friends who love her, and they will probably hit me when they hear me say that. But, you know, Lindsey Buckingham doesn't deserve to be in there either, and he has much better solo albums. And they've, of course, have had a big spat and a fallout. We'll get to that later. But we need more women in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If I had to choose, I would take Janet Jackson over Stevie Nicks.
John Prine, I'm going with yes.
I should like John Prine. I don't know why I don't listen to John Prine or haven't really embraced him. I've listened to his new album. I think it's pretty good, solid, not great. He is absolutely someone who should be in my wheelhouse, but I have never really listened to him. Just on reputation alone, I would figure he should be in there, but you know, I just don't know enough to vote for him.
Radiohead is a yes.
They should have been in there last year. They seem like a no-brainer. So absolutely. Big group, one hugely important album, OK Computer. Lots of very good albums and clearly one of the big bands of the last 20 years.
Rage Against the Machine, yes.
Good politics, not so into the music. I don't think they're that important or interesting.
Okay. I would beg to differ on that one. Although I understand the not being so into the music. I completely agree. And can relate to that. Roxy Music, of course, yes.
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. But there's a big prejudice in the Hall of Fame against British acts. You know, bands that would get into UK Hall of Fame immediately sort of are left standing and waiting. Not only should Roxy Music in there, especially because of, you know, Brian Eno, one of the most influential and important artists of all time. He should be in there as a solo act. He invented an entire genre, for God's sake. He's produced some of the best albums of all time for other artists. Major key work from Bowie and U2 and even James and other acts. But, you know, he invented ambient music. Hugely important artist. At the very least, he should be in there as a member of Roxy Music.
Rufus and Chaka Khan. I'm going with no.
Ain't nobody. Yeah, no, you know, a fun group, some great songs, great voice by Chaka Khan, but not a Hall of Famer body of work.
So Chaka Khan's not rocking you. Todd Rundgren. I'm going to go with no.
Yes, big time.
I knew it.
Todd Rundgren has a long career with a lot of great albums. I've really been turned on to him in the last few years by our friend Sal Nunziato, who's been on the show before. He's with burningwood.com. And he has great, great albums. He probably was more known and talked about in the 70s and early 80s when he was at his peak. You would recognize some of his radio hits. But not only has he had every few or 5 or 8 years a really great album, but he's also produced some of the really big albums of all time, like Meatloaf. Meatloaf.
Okay.
He did Meatloaf, Bad Outta Hell, and other albums for him and other acts. He did some of the best work for XTC, like Skylarking. He's done some of the best work for the band. Well, not the best work, but he worked with the band and other major acts. So he's been a big producer and a real, real talent as a sort of studio wizard a la Prince, where he's in there doing everything all on his own. So he has Utopia, he has his solo work, he has his producing work. Absolutely a Hall of Famer.
Finally, the Zombies. I'm going to say yes.
You know, I should say yes. I mean, they created one classic album, Odyssey and Oracles. It is on most anybody's list of some of the best albums of all time. When you look at the 500 best, they will be on there with their album, Odyssey and Oracles. You don't have to have a big body of work to get in the Hall, but it helps. They really have nothing else other than that album. They've done one or two others, and people have done solo work. I wish there was a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame section for classic albums by acts that didn't get into the Hall. That, you know, I think the album deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. It's not a diss on the group as such. They created an album that deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That album should be ensconced in there. You know, like when they give a Grammy to like classic singles or albums, that should be in there. So the band to me doesn't have quite enough, but you know, they created one of the best albums of all time. So if you've never listened to it, start streaming.
Well, I see Billboard here. Their picks were Radiohead, Stevie Nicks, Janet Jackson, The Zombies, and Def Leppard.
Yeah, we matched twice, kind of. Really, once with just Radiohead. Right. Otherwise, I have no objection to The Zombies. I just feel like it's really just the album. Our friend Sal at Burning Wood, he and I were much more in tune. He did pick Kraftwerk, the MC5, Roxy Music, Todd Rundgren, and The Zombies. So I don't know if he would pick Mariah Carey, but she just announced her new album is coming out mid-November. That's a good example of an act who's been hugely successful and hugely influential, but in a really bad way. Because all the people doing the runs that they should not be doing, that she shouldn't be doing, she has been just a poisonous influence on music. But the big question, you know, who deserves to be in the hall? It's not rock and roll. It's a popular music hall of fame, obviously. We've got pop, rock, soul, country, jazz, but, you know, we've got all types of acts in there. So, you know, get over that. Rock music isn't rock. You know, the Wu-Tang Clan should be in there. And it's the question, will the music last? That's all you're saying. This act or this music will last. Do you think 100 years from now, we'll still be listening to it? It will still matter. That's the basic question. So, you know, that's what we're trying to answer.
Well, every week we ask you a question, and it's what book should we be reading? And we ask that question during our Book Filter section. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week on Book Filter, you're kind of going through all the releases and thousands of releases, and you're telling people what they should be reading, what the best books are. Here at Showbiz Sandbox, you bring one or two titles that are maybe ready for their close-up, ready for an adaptation to a movie or a television series. What have you got for us this week?
Well, this week it's sort of a slam dunk, no-brainer. It's The Library Book by Susan Orlean. She's the author, of course, of The Orchid Thief, which was turned into the film adaptation. Not a very successful film, I don't think. She also most recently wrote Rin Tin Tin, a biography of the four-legged star of Hollywood that helped save a studio or launch a studio, and just a fascinating history of Hollywood in general. So I am sure this book has already been optioned, though I haven't been able to find an evidence of that. The Library Book has about 100 different great ideas for a movie. I mean, there's so much stuff in this book. That's sort of her modus operandi. She sort of expands outward and finds all these different nooks and crannies, and, you know, looks at some issue and then, you know, finds so many rich and interesting elements to it. In this case, it was a fire in the Los Angeles library. It was in 1986, I think. I hope I have the year right.
I think that's about right. Yeah.
Right. So you're probably familiar with the fire, aren't you?
Yeah. And so the Central Library, which is in downtown at 5th and Hope Street, it's like right at the heart of the city. And it caught fire. The whole thing burned right to the ground. And they,
well, not true, but that's okay.
But I mean,
it was a disastrous fire. Absolutely.
Yeah, they had to rebuild it from the ground up, which is what they did. And so it's a beautiful library now and great facility. And so that's why I know that it burned.
Yeah, well, they actually were able to salvage a lot of some of the original structure, and they expanded on it and all that sort of stuff. But it was a disastrous fire. 400,000 books were destroyed completely. 700,000 were partially destroyed, or, you know, made you know, or were ruined. They weren't destroyed completely, but they were ruined from smoke or water or both. So 1.1 million books in all were damaged or completely destroyed. So it was a disaster. But most people haven't heard of the fire or remember it because it happened the same week as Chernobyl.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's right.
There was a nuclear meltdown. So everybody in LA knew about the fire. But Susan Orlean, who's like a book lover and loves libraries, you know, she's getting a tour of the LA library when she moved there. And the guy's like, oh, you know, the fire. She's like, the fire? Goes, the fire. She goes, what fire? And she couldn't figure out how she didn't hear about it. It was such, you know, it would have been national news, but it was overshadowed by the potential end of the world. So, you know, Chernobyl won out. But this book has great information about the history of the library, some terrific profiles of librarians from the past, early women heads of the library, like back in pioneer days, or this crazy guy who walked across the country to take up his job at the library, or actually at a newspaper, and then worked at the library. Even though he had no credentials, they kicked a woman out and put him in charge, but he ended up being pretty good, actually. This kid at the library today who is on the spectrum but is an expert on travel maps and helps them organize their travel maps. The fire itself is probably the least interesting aspect as in terms of making it into a movie, but that's interesting as well, about this out-of-work gay actor who said, yeah, I did it. He's like, I'm just kidding. No, I did it. Nah, I'm just joking. No, actually, I really said it. You know, I mean, he was just, he cannot tell the same story twice. So he drove everybody nuts. But a really terrific book, well worth checking out and being overdue at the library while you finish it.
So it's that long?
No, it's not that long. I'm just making a library joke.
Yeah, there is the one wall that they, you know, it's pretty much a modern structure now. There's one wall that they have that's from the old structure. It's kind of neat to see the new versus the old.
Very cool. And I'm sure they'll have a display of National Book Award nominees.
Oh, I'm sure they will. And this year, the finalists are, Michael, take it away.
Well, we have fiction, nonfiction, and young people's literature. I've read one of the books. out of all 15. That was my point here. Wow, how embarrassing. I've only read one of the books. I started to read one of the nonfiction books, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. That's by Sarah Smarsh. So I haven't finished that yet. And I read one of the young people's books, but there are always good books to find there. And it's a little humbling. It just reminds you how many books just come out every year and how many good books there are. Even though I'm reading stuff all the time, it's hard to stay on top of it.
How many have been on Book Filter in the top recommendations?
Well, I've made all of these picks for sure. So if you look at Book Filter every week, you would have seen me name Lauren Groff's Florida as one of the best books of the week, a book that you really should pay attention to. Certainly, The Indian World of George Washington, a history book, was in there. American Eden, a story about botany in the early days of America, that was on our list. Certainly, Heartland was one of the top picks. The New Negro by Jeffrey C. Stewart, The Life of Elaine Locke, that was on my list. So all of these books I am aware of. Christopher Paul Curtis, for example, is a well-known young adult novelist who's written a lot of books over the years that have gotten acclaim. His new book, The Journey of Little Charlie, made the shortlist for the National Book Awards. So if you look at my page every week, you will see books like these mentioned as, hey, I really want to read this. It's just I can't always get to it because there's 100 books every week coming out that are really good. So there's 40 books I pick every week at the most saying, hey, these are worth your attention. And out of that pile gets pretty big pretty quick. And guess what? That doesn't even include self-published books.
I know.
But according to a new survey, they estimate that in 2017, more than 1 million books were self-published. Maybe in the world or North America, I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to clarify there. But basically, they were using the ISBN number, which is a code used by libraries and book publishers to sort of identify books. It's not the Dewey Decimal, it's a different number. But they use that ISBN number to identify each unique edition of a book. So this book in paperback at this point is given an ISBN number. If you reissue it 20 years later in paperback, it'll get a new ISBN number. In audiobook, it has a different ISBN number, hardcover, ebook. They all have unique codes, and that's how they track books. And a lot of self-published authors will get an ISBN number because it's easier for them to keep track of their book and sell it on Amazon and elsewhere with that ISBN number.
Well, they won't take it at most retailers if you don't have one.
Well, they don't take self-published books, period, at most retailers. So that's not the issue. It's when you go to Amazon's Kindle service, you don't need an ISBN number. So even though they say 1 million books, it looks like based on the ISBN number traffic, I'm pointing out the fact that that doesn't really cover all the books that get self-published on Amazon.
Well, and what I would wonder is the way ISBNs are distributed, I wonder if they're just taking the blank number, you know, the blanket number and saying, okay, well, 1 million were doled out last year. Well, sometimes...
Well, no, they're looking at ones that have been circulated with actual titles.
Okay,
because people will reserve numbers and do all that sort of stuff and big publishers will buy them. So yeah, they're aware of that issue too. So yeah, it's just, guess what? A lot of books get self-published.
Well, I don't know who do you think will win national? Well, you haven't read any of them, so you have no idea which.
No, I think Heartland is probably a front runner for nonfiction. I love M.T. Anderson, but his book in young adult I don't think is that good, so I hope that doesn't win. That's not very nice, but I love his work. This one I just don't think is up to snuff. In fiction, I don't have a good sense there, but Lauren Groff certainly is one of the biggest names there, so her book Florida is probably a front runner.
Well, she might be the biggest name, but I'm wondering what the biggest deal is in this week's segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop. And that's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, oh my goodness, this is, I know what the answer is to this, but we'll go through it anyway. Because Hollywood has been chomping at the bit to do business in Saudi Arabia, a country where women are essentially under house arrest. And only recently were granted the privilege of driving a car, to which I would say, oh my God, just take Uber. I mean, even I don't want to drive. Nonetheless, Hollywood wants Saudi money and it wants to open movie theaters, just like it does in the UAE and other countries with questionable human rights practices. But now that a dissident Saudi was reportedly killed and dismembered in Istanbul, and that person is a journalist, suddenly Hollywood is feeling a little sheepish. Financial heavyweights are too embarrassed to attend a conference no one would have thought twice about going to even a week ago. And now Hollywood companies are offering no comment or bland statements of concern when asked about their relationship with the royal dictator of that country, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. They're hoping this is just a bump in the road, but is it, in fact, a big deal or a big whoop? I don't even know why I'm asking that question.
It's definitely a big whoop.
What?
Of course it is, because Hollywood's just going to lay low. They're canceled this conference. People didn't go to the conference. Big deal. They're not going to stop doing business. They want to make money. They don't care about the human rights record in that country. They'll wait a week, a month, a year, and then continue with the business that they're doing. They don't give a damn about the human rights record of Saudi Arabia. They don't give a damn about women or gays or Jews or freedom of the press or the enslaved labor in Dubai, where lots of Hollywood people go and have film festivals and have second homes. They don't care about any of that. They care about making money, and they will just weather the storm and then go and say, hey, MBS, I'm ready to do a deal. They don't, you know, this will all blow over. Endeavor, look at that. Look what they said. Oh, we're very concerned.
Endeavor, oh, you mean the talent agency Endeavor, which was planning on getting about $400 million from the Saudi wealth fund.
And now they have officially pulled out of that deal.
Oh, they have. Okay.
They just announced that just like mere moments ago. But that was because it happened at a really bad time. So Ari Emanuel, like earlier today or yesterday, said, well, we're really concerned. And now they feel pressured to pull out of it. But you know what? 6 months from now, a year from now, they'll do another deal.
Yeah. I mean, I think the name of the journalist is Jamal Khashoggi. I think it was a miscalculation on the Saudis' part to think that they could get away with this.
Well, they've gotten away with a ton. So this was just, you know, this was a little, not a bridge too far. It's just gotten a little more traction than they would have liked to see. So again, they'll all just weather the storm and then it'll be back to business as usual down the road. I wish it wasn't, but it will be. And until all of Hollywood stops doing business in the UAE and all the other countries with horrific human rights records, you know, now, as you said, hey, they're all doing business in China, aren't they?
Right.
And that's true. That's true. China is a market and a country you can hardly ignore. But, you know, so that's a little different, I think, than some of the Middle Eastern countries. I think where those countries, you have more of an ability to say, well, maybe we can, you know, stick to our ethics. It's less costly to stick to your ethics in a smaller country. But maybe that's cynical, but at least it's a start. And I have to say it as a person who was wrong about the boycott of South Africa. I thought the boycott was wrong. I thought companies should do business and follow the rules set up by Bishop Desmond Tutu, where you make sure you have integrated employees and black employees get paid the same as white employees. And you sort of dismantle apartheid from within. That was sort of the idea of not divesting. That was what I supported, but I was wrong. And the people in South Africa said, no, the boycott really helped and really worked. You should have done that because the only thing they will respond to is money. And I'll bet the same is true in the UAE and the Middle East and Saudi Arabia. So, you know, I was wrong before. This time, I'm not going to be wrong.
Well, I just have one thing that I need to remind everybody of, no matter where you are. If you are a public figure, get off Twitter.
Oh, by the way, where's your conference that you're going to in next week?
Yeah, it's in Dubai. So thank you for including this story.
It was before you told me that. Yes, get off Twitter. Get off social media.
Yeah, that's the best advice one can give to Hollywood players. Writer Chuck Wendig has just been dumped by Marvel, and he says it's over his tweets. Wendig wasn't posting discriminatory tweets, just crass ones. Wendig has been an out there liberal for years. He introduced a gay character into the Star Wars universe, and Prejudice fans went absolutely crazy, just as they have recently over the prominence of female characters. Wendig mocked them in the most vulgar manner possible. Recently, his not ready for primetime language has continued. Right-wing activist groups targeted him just as they targeted director James Gunn. Marvel said, hey, you know, why don't you take a hike? Of course, Disney said the same to Gunn, and now he's directing the next Suicide Squad film for DC, so maybe not such a smart move. Is Wendig's exit a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because, you know, studios, he should not be on Twitter necessarily, but studios should catch their breath. You know, they jump so quickly and they fail to distinguish between somebody who uses crass language in his personal account, which may be his own business, versus somebody who's attacking women and blacks and Jews and gay. You know, he's defending the rights of people. He's speaking up for other people, and right-wing hate groups don't like him, and they got Marvel to fire him. You know, just as like they got Marvel to fire James Gunn, not because they were offended by what he said or did, but because they don't like what he stands for politically. And they said, oh, look, 10 years ago, he said some stupid things that he has apologized for repeatedly and made amends for and shown he regrets. And yet they dumped him too. So, you know.
So I guess what we've learned here when it comes to dealing with right-wing groups is deny, deny. But unfortunately, he couldn't because it was on Twitter. Because
not deny. He doesn't need to deny anything. He was crass. He did not say, I hate, you know, he was not spreading hate towards anyone. No, he's just saying, that was, you guys are jerks.
That was more a reference to the recent Supreme Court debacle.
Well, there you go. Yeah. But so, again, you know, it's not like, oh, he has liberal views, therefore I say, you know, support him. No, it's, he wasn't attacking anybody. He wasn't spreading hate. Therefore, there's no reason for your company to freak out. But yes, get off Twitter. You know, or if you want to be on there, try to be there in a way that's not going to embarrass the companies you work for. You can be as progressive or as conservative as you want. Try to do it without, you know, trafficking in language that is so, you know, nasty that your company has an excuse to fire you. But really, I blame Marvel for this. And DC, that's a great pickup, isn't it?
Yeah, very smart of them, because he's obviously talented, James Gunn, that is.
And he's not a negative in terms of anything he's done in the last 10 years. He should be a guy you're happy to work with.
Right.
And he's going to really, you know, so they've got James Gunn, and while Spielberg hasn't made a great movie in a while, he's making a movie for DC. James Gunn is, you know, they need to do something, and they're doing it.
Remember the Fry Music Festival? That was the
Not really.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. That was the lavish music festival planned to be held in Paradise, which by Paradise, we mean an island with no toilet facilities. it collapsed in a spectacular way. Unless you actually bought a ticket, it might have faded from your memory. See Michael for that, by the way. Well, the guy behind that con is going to jail for 6 years. We're labeling Michael, listen to me, Billy McFarland a con artist because he was found guilty of that, and because the idea that he just got in over his head is kind of absurd. Turns out he ran all sorts of scams, like selling people fake tickets to the Grammys and other big splashy events. At best, maybe McFarland decided it would be easier to just create a real festival than to keep counterfeiting tickets, but he misled people every step of the way and is now paying the price. Big deal or big whoop.
Yeah, I mean, that you sort of, I didn't ever feel sorry for him, but you thought, well, maybe, you know, the argument was, oh, we just got in over our heads. You're like, well, maybe they did. But no, when you find out the rest of his history, A, he would like literally just sell counterfeit tickets to stuff. Hey, you want to go to the Oscars? Here's a ticket. And then you pay $20,000 and then you show up and you don't get in. So clearly a con artist, but I love the idea that he said, why am I should just do this. Let's make a real festival. It really seems to be the genuine desire they had, except he's so used to being a con artist that he didn't know how to go legit. And he didn't know how to make promises or be honest with people when problems arose. If he had been, he might have been able to pull it off.
Right.
But since it was all just a house of cards to begin with, I think he actually intended and hoped to have an actual music festival. I don't think he was intending to have it just not actually exist. He thought he could pull it off, but he's too used to just conning people. So, you know, he couldn't actually pivot to honesty. So he's in jail. So good for him.
Hulu is launching a TV series about the iconic rap band, the Wu-Tang Clan. Famously torn between their art and the easier lore of criminal activity to survive, the Wu-Tang chose art and created a body of work among the most influential in all of hip-hop. Hulu said, hey, let's tell their story. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess Apple passed on this one.
Oh, you're saying that because they did the Dr. Dre story and then went, oh, yeah. My God, we can't air that.
Oh, my, I need my vapors, my smelling salts. Yes. So, you know, my goodness, sex and drugs and rock and roll. I had no idea. So hopefully Hulu is paying attention to the actual script and will know what they're filming and doing and will approve it and be part of it creatively. So they're paying attention. But my God, the deal's being done in TV. 50 Cent just signed a huge deal. John Legend is, of course, doing big deal. It feels like everybody in Hollywood and music is signing big TV production deals or big TV projects. It just seems like that's where all the money and action is.
Can I tell you something? I went to the Women in Entertainment Summit last week. And by the way, you know, as a straight guy, it was fantastic. I was like the only guy in the room. 400 women and me. But that said, Susan Cartsonis was on the panel. She's a producer, great producer. And she did a deal with Netflix and they did her movie. And she said that the movie did very well for them, or so they tell her. So I thought that was like, you know, very funny because, of course, nobody knows how well a movie does there. And, you know, this just happened to be a summit for women. However, every screenwriter that I talk to, you ask them, well, what kind of screenwriting do you do? Oh, 1 hour episodic dramas. 20 years ago, you never would have said you did television. You would, that would, like, television was movie jail, you know? And now it's like all anybody wants to do is television. The amount of streaming money into this industry is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And we'll get to that in, I guess, in the Inside Baseball. Because
oh,
really,
yeah, I guess I could have brought that up during Inside Baseball. But yeah, it's remarkable how, I mean, it's really putting a lot of people to work.
Yeah, you make it sound like they've been sitting at home all this time.
Well, no, but I mean, you know what I mean.
Yeah. So Wu-Tang Clan, they've got a TV show and they deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They've only got 4 albums, but they're a hugely important group.
The IATSE union members have voted to ratify a new 3-year deal with producers. Now, IATSE, they do, you know, grips, gaffers, they do a lot, actually. The objections of one local looked set to spark an uprising, but after some ugly words and accusations flying back and forth, most locals voted to support the deal their leaders had cut. That means some key issues around streaming and their pension have been punted, but it does mean stability for the business in the short term. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal. You know, it does mean stability, but I'm with locals. I think it was 700.
Yes.
I think this was a bad deal. I don't know. They didn't really address the big issues that they had to tackle. And I just wish it hadn't happened. It just seems a shame, but, you know,
yeah,
there you go.
These are all like the you know, I think casting directors are in IATSE.
No, they're Teamsters.
Teamsters. Okay. I knew that they were part of some union.
No, my friend's a casting director and she is a proud Teamster.
Okay. Well, Fleetwood Mac dumped Lindsey Buckingham from their lineup right before a lucrative new tour. The remaining band members hated to use the word fired, but, you know, he was gone. They told their story that Buckingham refused to tour when they wanted to. Then Buckingham told his story, and it goes something like this. Stevie Nicks got fed up and said it was either him or her. So they fired him, and now he's suing. It's the latest and far from the nuttiest in a band that only recently saw the classic 70s lineup back together when Christine McVie unretired from the band. Even then, Nicks didn't want to record a new album. I mean, why bother, she thought. So Buckingham and McVie did a duets project. We'd suggest it might lead to another great breakup album a la Rumors, but Stevie doesn't want to do a new album, so we'll just ask, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, you know. I mean, this band has been through so many changes over the years. Christian McVie retired for ages. Now they've got one of the Finn brothers in the band and a great guitarist who joined the group. Someone else did too. I forget who the two new people are.
Oh, it's the guy from Crowded House.
No, yeah, it's Tim Finn, but I forget who the other one is.
Yeah, I have to double.
That's a shame. I'm sorry about that. I'm being stupid. But it just seems ugly. And I have to say, Lindsey Buckingham is winning the war here in terms of PR. He said basically they were at some Music Cares event and he was annoyed by the music that they chose to introduce the group. And it was a Stevie Nicks song and she was annoyed that he was annoyed. And then she gave a speech and he insists that they all have a long-term thing where, you know, he has a running joke that when she talks too long and he sort of looks bored, like, oh my God, she's going on. And he said, I sort of rolled my eyes, but that's what I've done for decades. And in fact, Mick and Christine were dancing in the background as if they wanted something else to do, but she saw him and got angry at him and that was it. She says, you know what? We were never married, but we might as well have been. So it's kind of like a divorce and the other kids are suffering and it's too bad. But, you know, we got a lot of back stuff that we've dealing with here. But his lawyers released an email. You know, they sort of dumped him and he was like, he thought Stevie Nicks was leaving the group. Yeah. And then he's like, after 2 days, he was emailing. He didn't want to bother Christine because he felt she was a little more vulnerable. She just rejoined and he didn't want to make her feel like she was in the middle. So he sort of reached out to Mick, et cetera, and they didn't respond. And so he finally emailed them again. He's like, well, what's going on? And then finally, lawyers reach him like, no, you're fired. And before that happened, he had sent an email to them and that his lawyers released before he was officially publicly fired when they were arguing back and forth. And you gotta feel for him here. He says, after 43 years and the finish line so clearly in sight, it's hard to escape the conclusion that for the five of us to splinter apart now would be the wrong thing. At the moment, the band's heart and soul has been diminished, but our center, which had seen us through so much, is only laying dormant. And you're like, yeah, you know, it's like, really now at the end, really like this, they don't have many tours left in them. So I feel for him, and I feel like, yeah, that sentiment was a genuine one. And it's a shame that they aren't able to work this out.
But, especially, you know, since he's one of the founders of the band.
Well, no, he most certainly is not. Fleetwood Mac was around long before Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joined in the early 70s. And
that's true. You're right.
Yeah, no, they have a great, great pre, you know, pop music career in blues. They kind of invented the genre that, you know, Allman Brothers and others, that sort of country rock sprawling jam band sound. I mean, the Play On is a great album. I mean, Fleetwood Mac has a couple great, great albums before those guys
yeah,
ever
came right.
on the scene. Yeah, so, you know, it's hard.
I always
not
forget
to get
about that, though.
Yeah, no, I know, but great, great work. They deserve to be in the Hall of Fame for the pre-Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks era. I mean, great stuff. But yeah, it's hard not to get excited by this because it's such drama. It's Fleetwood Mac. Dear God, they're in their 70s and they're like, we're breaking up. Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And we were just talking about this, Michael.
It's the great streaming land rush. Everybody wants a streaming platform. Everybody wants a streaming app. Everybody wants a streaming service. They're all spending billions of dollars on content because they all want to compete with Netflix. It's exciting.
Yes, and it's like, Oprah, you get a streaming platform and you get a streaming platform. But now, okay, let's start with Jeffrey Katzenberg because the wait is over. Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman, they launched a new TV service. It was going to be built around content created to be seen in short bursts of like 5 or 15 minutes. It was perfect for commuting and short attention spans.
It's exactly the opposite of what we do.
Correct.
We're like, give us an hour and a half and we'll give you 5 minutes worth of information.
Well, okay, so it was a new way of doing TV, basically, and they used the phrase new TV, but they said it won't be called new TV. In fact, the people who owned the newtv.com domain were like, hey, it ain't us, okay? We'll come up with something better, they said. The result was Quibi, yeah. That's short for quick bites, the idea of TV content you can nibble on? I don't really know. They've got powerhouse talent lined up because they've got $1 billion to spend, so you know folks are happy to oblige. Guillermo del Toro has a zombie show. Antoine Fuqua is doing some sort of TV show that's sort of like Dog Day Afternoon. Sam Raimi is doing an anthology called 50 States of Fear, and Jason Blum will scare the bejesus out of you, but he'll do it really quickly, just, you know, really fast.
That's right.
Yeah, so Quibi...
I mean, whatever, right? It doesn't really matter. If it clicks, people won't think twice about it. You know what? You've got...
You'd think I would have learned my lesson after saying, really? Hulu? Come on. You couldn't come up with a better name than Hulu? That's never going to fly.
Yeah, Quibi. Who cares? But like the fact that they didn't have that ready 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago when they announced it is just bizarre to me. That's just incompetent because they had 1,000 stories written about new TV where they didn't have the name of the company to promote. So that's really incompetence in my mind. That's just not a good sign.
No.
Well, and I don't get it. There are so many services that have quick bites of TV, which we've already gone through, from all the music videos on YouTube to all the late night shows that create content constantly meant to be consumed in little quick bites. You know, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, what's his name? The Brit. What's his name?
John Oliver? Yes,
no, the young
Trevor,
guy.
Trevor Noah?
No, the late night show guy.
James Corden?
Karaoke. James Corden. Good Lord. Yeah, I mean, they're all creating short little bits of content along with, you know, a million music videos. So the idea that this is a space that needs content or like this is a new idea is absurd. But if they create good content, I guess it won't matter. You know, if you create something people want to watch, okay, you'll get an audience.
See Handmaid's Tale.
Right. But that doesn't mean that the company or service is, you know, worth $1 billion launch.
No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying if you want to be successful, you know, make good content a la.
Right. That doesn't mean that you couldn't have just created good content and placed it on one of the million services that already exist and are ready to deal with your content of short burst entertainment.
Here's the question.
Spend all the money to create your own site is questionable to me.
Here's a question for you. So the other day I had to set up my daughter's iPhone. She, you know, had to change phones, and I saw, oh, she's using Snapchat. Okay. I'm like, oh yeah, Snapchat. I remember that. I mean, I used it for all of about 5.5 seconds and probably, I think I used it for one weekend, to be honest with you. Have you ever used Snapchat, Michael?
I probably have, but I don't use it regularly for sure.
Yeah.
They're but actually, my nephew used Snapchat, actually. Because do they erase it right after it appears when you do notes and things?
Yeah, things like, yes.
So my nephew actually just mentioned that you use Snapchat to communicate with someone, but doesn't have evidence of it because it erases immediately.
Correct. and they're doing original series and documentaries. I can't find them. I have no idea where they are on the app. I'll be honest.
Well, that's why they're updating the app. So Snapchat has been doing bite-sized entertainment, just like Quibi, for a while. And now they're doubling down on what they call mobile TV. They have an updated app, and it makes it much easier to find shows and watch them from the first episode. So you're right. Previously, it was a total mess. And you know, like, even if you knew a show you wanted to watch, to find the episode you wanted to watch or start at the beginning was kind of really hard. So they have fixed that with their new app. You just have to re-download it. They are focusing on daily episodes, unlike, say, Netflix, which loves to drop a whole season at once. They find putting out one episode a day, I assume 5 days a week, that's the rhythm that works for their audience. So they are launching some scripted shows to go with the reality stuff, like Snap Originals is what it's all called. And they're all basically shot in the vertical format. They're all about 5 minutes in length. They include quick cuts, and they're optimized for watching on your smartphone. So they're saying, you're going to watch on your smartphone. Each episode will be 5 minutes long. Here you go. And every day, there's a new one. That's their plan. Sounds a lot like Quibi, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, in fact. It sounds like the IGTV, Instagram TV, at the Women's Conference, Women in Entertainment Summit. There was a woman who was in charge of IGTV, and I said, oh my God, Instagram has TV too? I had no idea. And she was there, like, you know, on the panel from the dais, like, you know, Instagramming us. I was like, what is this? What are you doing? And she was adding to her story. And I was like, okay. But you know, what do I know? Apparently I'm not, you know, social media literate.
That's why you have to ask the kids what they're doing.
Right. Speaking of media.
What's Warner Media doing?
Well, everybody kind of knew this was going to happen. Pretty much everyone, as we say, is going to have one of these streaming platforms. Disney is doing one. And while HBO is already out there as a standalone channel, Warner Media literally just launched DC Universe, okay? An entire channel devoted to DC and led by its flagship show, Titans. Well, that's not enough. Warner Media said they too are going to launch a streaming platform. It's going to include HBO and their library and their content engines, and it's going to launch in 2019, and it's going to be awesome, okay? All of those things. Their budget is going to be, quote-unquote, competitive, who knows what that means, with the $8 billion spent annually by Netflix. Hey, we should turn this podcast into a TV show, or at least create a fictional TV show about the wacky goings-on behind the scenes every week when we record the podcast, which actually wouldn't be fictional because it is kind of wacky. Anyway, for the love of God, they're spending billions of dollars on this content.
That's right, billions. So what does competitive mean? I assume it means at least $4 billion. And that's just yet another big honeypot of money that is being poured into creating content. And we are already at a stage where there's so much more content than we already need. And what are they going to charge, and who's going to buy it? I don't know who's buying DC. I get HBO standalone, but they're not creating an entire, you know, cable channel lineup of television. It's just Warner stuff. So it's not like you'll get HBO, DC, and then, you know, ESPN. No. It's just another standalone service. We've got too much TV already. Everyone is creating a service and expecting us to plunk down $5 or $10 a month just for the privilege of looking at it.
You know what I think? I think I'm going to start a new business. Okay, here's what it's going to be. I'm going to, like, go and cut deals with all of these different streaming services. Okay, and then I'm going to put them in, like, I don't know, like a basket or a bundle. I'm going to put them in a bundle, and then I'm going to sell just the bundle, and then you'll get access to Warner Media, you'll get access to Disney, you'll get access to, you know, Quibi.
And it'll cost $370 a month.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
It'll cost too much.
Oh, okay. Would it be more than my cable bill? Because if it is, then that's a problem.
Right. I just don't get it, that they think everyone's going to want all these things. They're going to want CBS All Access, and they're going to want all these things. It just, to me, some of these things are going to die. They're going to have to die. I don't see, or they're going to start bundling together.
You know what? This is every, read The Master Switch by Tim Wu. It's every single land rush starts this way, where there's too many, just like there were like 400 telephone companies at one point, and eventually it was Ma Bell, you know, AT&T. It's the same thing. They were like,
but they're splintering again. We've had the land rush, and then we created the packages. They just got greedy and charged too much, and now they think the solution is to just charge you individually for every channel, as if they're going to make up for the lost revenue. But they're not going to. If people want something, they want a skinny bundle where they have a lower price than their $130 a month cable bill. So I don't understand how they think they're going to trick everyone into signing up for 400 individual services. It's not going to work. It's a land rush towards something where there is no gold to be found. I have more TV than I know what to do with already. Why do they think I want to pay extra for even more?
Wait, you don't want to pay extra for more TV? Come on.
No, I don't think so. I think it's a big, I think it's a service in search of a customer. I really do. Do I want to pay for CBS All Access? No, I'd like to watch the new Star Trek TV series. I ain't going to pay you $5 a month for the privilege. Not happening.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not either, so I guess I can't really argue with you on this.
Right. I mean, maybe you have Amazon because you have Amazon Prime. Do you?
I do, actually.
And you pay for Netflix, right?
I don't pay.
What about Hulu?
Netflix. I don't pay for Hulu,
because you have a cable bill, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe you would add, if you added something, you'd probably start with CBS All Access, Warner Media, DC. No, you'd probably start with Netflix.
Let's put it this way. You didn't ask me whether I have Netflix.
Shame on you. Shame on you.
I love that joke that's used countless times by any number of presenters that say, I don't understand how Netflix has so many customers, and when everybody knows we're all sharing the same password.
Ba-dum-bump.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, on a less funny note, is obituaries. I think some of those businesses are going to die because I don't think there's the audience demand for it.
And Emmy-winning sound mixer James Emswiller, he died on the set of the new Tom Hanks movie, which is about Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers. He reportedly was on a balcony having a cigarette break when he fell off and died hours later at the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, they're investigating, of course, as every on-set death will be investigated, but it sounds like just an awful tragedy. Nothing to do with the stunts or something going awry as such, though, whether that was balcony was safe or whether, who knows. But very sad news, of course, anytime someone dies on a set, because you just don't think people should die. People die at work, though, don't they?
And they absolutely do.
Yeah. So, Mr. Emswiller won an Emmy for working on the HBO movie. Speaking of HBO, that was Bessie, the story of Bessie Smith starring Queen Latifah. He also had other credits like The Fault in Our Stars and Foxcatcher, which was a pretty good movie. So, you know, he's a very active member of the industry working away on a big new movie, and a very, very sad news.
And Carol Haley, the music and she wrote music and lyrics for Best Little Whorehouse. I guess it's Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, though, isn't it?
That's the full name, right. She died at 82. She was one of the few women to do music and lyrics for a Broadway show at all. And that show was a big hit, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Big hit from Tommy Tune, turned into a disastrous film starring Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton is still going strong. But Carol Haley also worked on the Marlo Thomas TV special, Free to Be You and Me. And she also worked on Sesame Street, so she had a great career. She wrote songs like Hard Candy Christmas, which was a country perennial, frankly, still is. And Parents Are People, which is, you know, debatable. But
hey,
there you go.
I take umbrage to that remark.
Well, that was meant for you. Absolutely. Just ask kids. Interesting, cool career. I've never seen The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. They're talking about maybe doing a revival. But she died at 82, and a great, full, fascinating career. Did you ever see Free to Be You and Me?
I have not, no.
It's like a touchstone for people, and it was around my time. I should know it, but it's a blank spot where that TV special is.
Well, one thing that's not a blank spot this week is our listener email. In fact, I love our listeners when they write to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, because they fill us in on some really interesting stuff. And this week, I mean, the email was a little long, but I was like, how do I pare this down? But I thought, you know what? It's not that long. We should just read it.
That's right. It says, hey, Michael and Sperling. And it's from someone who calls themselves Hannah. So they send us the email, but obviously they're in the industry and they chose not to include their full name or their business. So we'll respect that. And Hannah is writing about boxing. She says, I have a comment about the story you discussed on episode 426 about HBO getting out of airing boxing matches. I can tell you from having worked in the boxing world for nearly 15 years now that it has always been run based on promoters. The promoters with the best boxers and biggest names were and are the most successful. Think Don King during the Mike Tyson era, and you'll get the picture. More recently, boxing promoters have become more corporate rather than personality driven, kind of like concert promoters. Some time ago, HBO cut a deal with Golden Boy Promotions, a company founded by former boxer Oscar De La Hoya, to broadcast all its fights on pay-per-view, for which it averaged roughly 1 million purchases per fight. Though not entirely exclusive, other promoters felt neglected. Meanwhile, other promoters started to attract big names and great boxers. Competition began to grow when ESPN cut a deal with Top Rank, which includes a new sports-specific streaming service, and together began drawing most of the best bouts. Even Goldboy cut a deal with Facebook to broadcast boxing on that platform. Their first fight earlier this year drew an astronomical 20 million viewers. I think that was a free viewing of a boxing match.
Yes, it was. It was free. Right.
So with its close ties to Golden Boy, HBO would not be able to draw the best fights and was causing them to lose money. Rather than continue to lose money, they scrapped the programming so they could reapproach it with a clean slate in a few years the way they should have in the first place by being agnostic to all promoters so they don't have to worry about which one has the best fighters. My prediction is that HBO will be returning to the sport around 2020 or 2021 in just that way. Keep playing nice, Hannah.
Well, Hannah, thank you for writing in. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, and it sounds true to you that HBO is not done with boxing, that they do want to get back in. There is a lot of new competition. They may find it hard to wend their way back into the business.
Yeah, I think they just want to figure out the best way to do it. And they were definitely, I think they fell asleep at the switch. I think they were kind of like on autopilot and they went, oh, wait, the industry changed. Huh.
Yeah, boxing was hugely important to them in the 70s and 80s and probably into the 90s when you sort of crossed their paths a little bit. And then it really faded in importance, just as comedy specials have. Now, comedy specials are owned by Netflix and a lot of others, and HBO is not a big player.
Right.
They've got Game of Thrones. They're busy creating a fantasy world. So, you know, they may wake up and say, you know what? We want sports back in the mix, and boxing is the way to do it. And Hannah says, look for that in 2020 or 2021. But you'll have to look for us in 3 weeks, because Sperling is going to be away, so we won't be back until the week of November 4th,
which is about the time when this episode will probably end, actually.
It ends be now. Done.
Okay, well, if that's the case, then you can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, Microsoft Marketplace. I got to get us on Spotify. That would probably help.
How do we do that?
I have to send us in, and yeah, I'm investigating it. I will look into it. But right now, please do subscribe to the show in any of those podcast aggregators. Rate, review us. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show when you do. Links to all of those stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us and ways to write to us, like Hannah, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's 3 weeks feels like forever.com.
You know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, because that might be easier, just saying. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 3 weeks from now, play nice.